Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to look at something that is almost certainly within 5 feet of you right now. It might be closer.
Oh, for sure.
It's holding up the roof over your head. It forms the skeleton of the building you're in. It's in the car you drive. And it's the backbone of every bridge you cross. We're talking about steel.
We are.
But, and stick with me here, we aren't just talking about those big, cold metal beams you see at a construction site. We're going to shrink ourselves down. Mm-hmm. Way down.
Right down to the microscopic level.
Exactly.
That's right. We're diving into the hidden architecture of the modern world. Because when you look at steel under a microscope, it isn't just a gray uniform blob. It is this incredibly intricate, beautiful landscape. It almost looks biological.
I was looking at the images from the source material you sent over. Mm-hmm. And honestly, specifically looking at this structure called perlite, it doesn't look like metal at all. It looks like a fingerprint.
That is the classic description. It has these beautiful alternating ridges and valleys. In fact, it was named perlite because the early metallurgists, when they etched it with acid and looked at it, thought it had the iridescence of mother of pearl.
It sounds delicate, but functionally, this is the heavy lifter of civilization.
Absolutely. If you need high strength, we're talking tire cords, suspension bridge ropes, heavy-duty rail lines. You're relying on perlite.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to the research we're analyzing today. It's a paper by Sangwoo Seo titled Perlite Growth Rate in FeSi Binary and FeXC Ternary Steel.
Which I know sounds remarkably dense.
It is heavy on the math, it won't lie. But the story underneath the math is fascinating. Because while we know what perlite is, there's been a massive, intense, decades-long fight in the scientific community about how it grows.
And that's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to unpack this diffusion debate. And I want to be clear to you listening. This isn't just academic hair splitting. If we don't understand the growth mechanism, we can't predict the strength of this steel, right?
Precisely. It comes down to control. If you're manufacturing a cable that needs to hold up a suspension bridge, you cannot leave the internal structure to chance. You need to know exactly what's happening to those atoms when the metal cools down.
You need to know how fast it grows and what shape it takes.
Yeah.
So let's visualize this before we get into the debate.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fingerprint look. What are we actually seeing there in that pattern?
You're seeing a lamellar structure. That's just fancy terminology for layered. Think of it as a stack of plates. But it's an interpenetrating bicrystal.
Interpenetrating bicrystal. Okay, that sounds like something from a sci-fi novel. Break that down.
It means you have two completely different materials growing together, interlocking perfectly. One layer is ferrite, which is almost pure soft iron. The next layer is cementite, which is iron carbide. Very hard, very brittle.
So it's a sandwich. Soft, hard, soft, hard.
Exactly. And that alternation is magic. The soft iron gives it ductility so it can bend, and the hard carbide gives it strength so it doesn't break. That sandwich structure is what makes perlite so useful.
Okay, so we have the what. Let's get to the how. The paper focuses on the growth rate. Now, usually, when I think of hardening steel, I think of a blacksmith taking a glowing orange sword and plunging it into water. Hissing steam, instant hardening.
Right.
But that's not what we're talking about here.
No, that quench creates something else entirely. We're talking about a diffusional transformation. This happens when the steel is cooling down, but the atoms are still hot enough to, you know, move around. It starts an apparent phase called austenite.
The austenite is the starting point, the primordial soup.
Think of austenite as a hot, chaotic party where all the iron and carbon atoms are mixed together evenly, everyone's mingling. But as the temperature drops, that mixture becomes unstable. The party's over.
So the atoms want to separate.
They want to separate into those two new phases, ferrite and cementite.
But for that to happen, physically, the atoms have to move. They have to reorganize themselves from a soup into a stack of plates.
Exactly. And this is where the choreography gets really interesting. Ferrite is essentially pure iron. It hates carbon. It has no room for it. It rejects it.
Oh, okay.
Cementite, on the other hand, is iron carbide. It needs carbon to exist.
So you have one layer throwing carbon out and the neighbor layer grabbing it.
That is the definition of cooperative growth. As these two layers grow side by side into that austenite soup, the ferrite pushes carbon sideways to the cementite, and the cementite gobbles it up. They share a common front, passing the carbon back and forth to keep growing forward.
And this mechanism brings us to the central conflict of the pager, the diffusion debate. The question is, how does the carbon actually get from the ferrite to the cementite?
It seems like such a simple question, doesn't it? Just move the carbon. But this question split metallurgists into two warring camps for a long, long time.
Introduce the fighters. Who is in corner one?
In corner one, you have the volume diffusion camp. This is the classic theory, often associated with the Zener-Hilliard model. They assume the carbon atoms swim through the bulk of the austenite.
So, through the soup itself?
Yeah, essentially swimming through the deep end of the pool to get from the ferrite tip to the cementite tip.
Okay, so they're swimming through the soup ahead of the growth. And corner two?
Corner two is the boundary diffusion camp. They argued, no, swimming through the bulk is too hard and too slow. They believed the atoms use the interface itself, the boundary between the new perlite and the old austenite, as a shortcut.
Or running along the edge of the pool deck instead of swimming through the water.
Exactly. It's a highway versus swimming argument.
So why was this a debate? Why couldn't they just measure it and see who was right?
Because neither model worked perfectly on its own. And Seo's paper highlights this ruthlessly. If you calculate the growth rate using only volume diffusion, the swimming method, you underestimate the speed by up to 50 times.
50 times? That's not a rounding error.
No, that's a catastrophe. It means the steel is growing way, way faster than the swimming theory says it should be possible.
So the volume people were wrong.
But here's the catch. If you use only boundary diffusion, the highway method, you run into problems when you start changing the temperature or adding other elements. It doesn't fit the experimental data across the board either.
So both models are flawed. Enter Sungwoo Seo. What's the solution proposed in this paper?
His solution is elegantly simple, though the math to get there is complex. He basically asks, why are we forcing the atoms to choose?
Nature doesn't deal in binaries.
Correct. Seo proposes a mixed diffusion-controlled growth model. The hypothesis is that the total flux of atoms, the flow, is a combination of both volume and boundary diffusion. If there's a highway, they use it. If they can swim, some will swim.
Nature uses every available path.
Every path to lower energy.
How do you even test that? You can't exactly watch individual atoms choose a lane under a microscope.
No, but you can measure the result. Seo used a technique called the maximum nodule radius method.
Nodule radius. We're talking about the size of the perlite colonies.
Yes. Perlite grows in these spherical colonies, or nodules. Imagine balloons inflating inside the metal. To find out the maximum theoretical speed of growth, you have to find the biggest colony in your sample.
Why the biggest? Why not the average?
Because the biggest one likely started first and grew without bumping into anything. If a colony bumps into another one, we call that impingement. It stops growing on that side.
I see.
So the biggest nodule represents the free run, the unhindered growth rate, where physics is the only limit, not neighbors.
Okay, so he takes this mixed diffusion math, applies it to these maximum nodule measurements. Does it work?
It works beautifully. Let's look at the simple case first. Binary steel, just iron and carbon.
Right.
When he applied the mixed model, the numbers just clicked into place. He compared it against classic experimental data from Brown and Ridley, and the fit was perfect.
And did the math tell us anything about which path the atoms prefer, the highway or the pool?
It did, and this is the validation part. The model spit out an activation energy for the boundary diffusion of about 125 kilojoules per mole.
I'm going to need you to contextualize that number. Is that high, low, good, bad?
It's exactly what physics predicts for boundary diffusion. It's significantly lower than the energy needed for volume diffusion. It proves mathematically that the boundary is the easier path.
Ah, okay.
And the model showed that at lower temperatures, the boundary flux dominates.
The highway is open and efficient.
Right. But as you get to higher temperatures, the volume flux starts playing a bigger role. The atoms have more thermal energy, so swimming becomes more viable.
So the answer to the debate was both. But the ratio changes depending on the heat.
Exactly. It's dynamic.
Okay. So that solves the mystery for simple steel, iron and carbon. But looking at the outline here, the plot thickens. We don't just use iron and carbon in the real world. We add stuff to make it better.
We do. We make ternary steels. Yeah. Fe-Xc. That X is the mystery guest. It's usually a substitutional element like manganese, nickel, chromium, or cobalt.
And I assume adding a third character to this intricate dance makes the choreography messier.
Much messier, because now you have a traffic jam problem.
I love a good traffic jam analogy. Lay it on me.
Think about the atoms again. Carbon is a small interstitial atom. It's tiny. It fits in the gaps between the iron atoms. It zips around like a motorcycle weaving through traffic. It's a fast diffuser.
Zoom, zoom.
But manganese is a substitutional atom. It's roughly the same size as iron. It sits in the actual iron lattice spots. To move, it has to shove iron atoms out of the way. It is a massive, heavy dump truck compared to the carbon motorcycle, a slow diffuser.
But for perlite to grow, Both have to move, right? The structure needs to rearrange.
That's the conflict. The fast carbon has to rate for the slow manganese. If the manganese doesn't move, the interface can't advance.
So how does the steel resolve this? Does it just stop growing?
It tries to find an equilibrium. We talk about two modes here, PLE and NPLE.
Okay, let's decode those acronyms before we move on.
PLE stands for partitioning local equilibrium. This happens when the process is slow enough that the manganese actually has time to move. It partitions. It sorts itself.
So the dump truck actually manages to change lanes.
Yes, but it takes forever. It drags the whole growth rate down. But then you have NPLE, negligible partitioning local equilibrium.
Which means?
It means the interface is moving too fast. The manganese doesn't have time to partition. It just gets trapped.
The dump truck gets paved over.
Essentially, it forms a spike in concentration right at the interface. It creates a pileup. Because it can't get away fast enough, the interface just blasts past it, leaving the manganese trapped in the ferrite or cementite.
In amounts it wouldn't normally accept.
Exactly.
And does CO's mixed diffusion model handle this traffic jam?
It handled it surprisingly well for manganese, nickel, and cobalt. The math predicted exactly when the perlite would grow normally and when it would struggle due to this pileup. It calculated the height and width of that concentration spike perfectly.
Which brings us to what I think is the most cinematic part of this paper, the mystery of the spiky perlite.
Oh, this is fascinating. This is where the theory confronts a physical reality check. This is the climax of the research.
Set the scene for us.
So, CO and his team are testing a specific steel, iron, 0.8% carbon, 1.0% manganese. They cook it at two different temperatures to watch it grow.
Temperature one, 958 Kelvin.
At 958 Kelvin, everything is polite, normal. You get those nice classic spherical colonies we talked about, the fingerprint.
Mm-hmm.
The ferrite and cementite are growing side by side, holding hands, moving forward cooperatively.
Then they drop the temperature to 823 Kelvin.
And chaos ensues. The cooperative growth completely breaks down.
Describe breaks down. What are we looking at in the microscope?
Instead of spheres, the growth becomes jagged, spiky. The smooth layers disappear. The cementite actually breaks into little disconnected particles stranded in the ferrite. The sandwich has fallen apart.
Now, for a metallurgist, this must be confusing. I read that they initially thought it was a different material entirely.
They did. Their first thought was, is this bainite?
Remind us what bainite is.
Bainite is another microstructure that forms at lower temperatures, but bainite forms differently. It's a displacive transformation, meaning the atoms shift together in unison, like a military drill, rather than diffusing individually like civilians in a crowd.
Oh, right.
And because it's a physical mechanical shift of the lattice, it changes the shape of the surface. It creates bumps.
So they tested for bumps.
They checked for surface relief. If it was bainite, the surface would be rough, but it wasn't. It was smooth.
So it wasn't bainite. It was perlite that had gone horribly wrong.
It was a diffusional transformation that failed. And here is the victory for CO's model. The mixed diffusion model explained why.
It comes back to the traffic jam.
It comes back to the spike. Yeah. The model calculated the depth of the concentration spike of the manganese at that lower temperature. Remember, it's colder, so the manganese is moving even slower. The pileup is getting worse.
How bad was the pileup?
The math said the spike was less than one angstrom deep.
One angstrom. That's the scale of a single atom.
Exactly. The concentration gradient became so sharp, so localized, that it physically broke the mechanism. The interface couldn't handle a traffic jam that dense compressed into a single atomic layer.
Wow.
The cooperative mechanism, where they pass carbon back and forth, shattered because the manganese blocked the path.
That is incredible. So the spiky perlite is basically the visible wreckage of a traffic accident at the atomic level.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. And the crucial point is that the old models, volume only or boundary only, could not predict this. They wouldn't have shown that the spike depth became critical at that specific temperature. Only the mixed diffusion model saw it coming.
It's a huge validation.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed in the notes there was one exception, one element that refused to play by the rules.
The one that got away, chromium.
Was chromium's problem.
When they applied the model to chromium steels, the predictions were way off. Not just a little bit, but by an order of magnitude.
That's a significant miss. Mm. Why did it fail there?
It comes down to chemistry. We call it off-diagonal diffusivity.
Which sounds like something from Star Trek, but I assume it means the atoms are interacting.
It means the movement of one element affects the movement of the other. See, nickel and cobalt don't interact that strongly with carbon chemically. They're just existing in the same space.
Right.
But chromium, Chromium is a strong carbide former. It loves carbon.
It's sticky?
Very sticky. It wants to bond with the carbon chemically. The current math in the mixed diffusion model treats them mostly as independent travelers dodging each other. It ignores that complex chemical attraction.
So the model is great for traffic, but not for romance.
Essentially, yes. If the cars start holding hands on the highway, the traffic model breaks.
There was one other technical nugget in the paper regarding interface energy.
Yes. This was a smaller but significant finding. The model calculated the energy required to create the ferrite-cementite interface, the glue between the layers. And the number came out higher than what other researchers have measured in static experiments.
Static meaning when the steel isn't growing.
Right, when it's just sitting there. This suggests that a growing interface, a dynamic moving front, might be fundamentally different, energetically speaking, than a static one.
Which makes intuitive sense. Running requires a different energy state than standing still.
Exactly.
So pulling this all together, we've gone from swimming atoms to highway shortcuts to manganese traffic jams and spiky explosions. What's the big takeaway here?
The big takeaway is that we've moved past the binary. We aren't arguing volume or our boundary anymore. We have a unified mixed solution that explains the real-world behavior of steel, including the weird anomalies like spiky formations.
And this matters because?
Because the world is built of this stuff. If you can model that spiky transition, you can process steel more safely. You can ensure that your bridge cables are lamellar and strong and not jagged and brittle. It allows us to push the material closer to its limits without failure.
There's one final thought in the source material that I found really provocative. It mentioned the holy grail of steel microstructure.
Oh, yes. This is the frontier. We talked about bainite earlier, that military drill transformation.
Yeah.
For decades, metallurgists have argued about where perlite ends and bainite begins. It's always been a blurry line.
The transition zone.
Sienna suggests that this spiky perlite might be the missing link. It is clearly diffusional atoms moving individually, but it's chaotic and non-cooperative. It might be the evolutionary bridge between the orderly growth of perlite and the sudden shifts of bainite.
So if we can model this spiky chaos...
If we can model the chaos, we might finally understand the unified theory of steel transformation. We could predict the entire life cycle of the microstructure from liquid to solid through every phase.
That is incredibly cool. It's amazing to think that inside a solid bar of cold steel, there's this frantic race, traffic jams, and boundaries breaking down.
It is a dynamic universe in there. We just needed the right math to see it.
Well, next time you cross a bridge or check your tires, just imagine that microscopic race of carbon and manganese atoms that holds it all together. That's all for today's deep dive. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Stay curious.